Welcome back, I'm Erin. In this episode, I play the audio of a Q&A session with former law enforcement officer and private investigator, Guy Parody. Guy answers questions that were proposed by members of the Disappearance of Maura Murray discussion Facebook group. The questions are asked by one of the administrators of the group, Sarah, who compiled the questions and set up the meeting with Guy. I would note that the other administrator, Melissa, helped to plan the Q&A as well, but was unfortunately unable to join us on the 29th. Just as a brief background, Guy was a member of the New Hampshire League of Investigators, which began looking into the case shortly after Maura's disappearance. He's been a police officer, a detective, a federal agent, and the chief investigator for the state of Vermont's Serious Felony Unit. He's also an expert in crime scene and accident reconstruction. For those of you who don't know Sarah, she's a graduate student in criminology and a New Hampshire native that has been following Maura's case since the beginning. She's also played a key role in reintroducing Guy to the case. And without her effort, we probably wouldn't have his knowledge, experience, and resources at this point. So thanks to Sarah for that and for continuing to promote constructive conversation about the case both in and out of her group. Just a few quick notes. At several points, Guy refers to a John, and I just want to be clear about the fact that the person he's referring to is John Healy, who is the leader of the New Hampshire League of Investigators. Also, I was primarily intending for my role to be that of a recorder and spectator, but I ended up interjecting a little bit more than I anticipated, so in case you're wondering, that's why my audio sounds a little bit distant. As always, let me know if there are any follow-up questions or clarifications. And here's part one of the Q&A with Guy and Sarah.
My name is Guy Parody. I'm a retired detective lieutenant from the Rutland City Police Department in Vermont. I'm also a retired homicide detective from the state of Vermont as well. I was one of the original people working on the Maura Murray case basically from day one with our league, and happy to be here.
I think there's been a lot of misconceptions.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there's a lot of misinformation, whether it's purposeful or not.
Yeah.
I think it's just become a big muddy mess.
Yes.
So nobody knows what to believe anymore or what's actual fact and what's not. So I'm hoping that after this, after some information from you, we can clear some of that stuff up.
Yeah. Fire away.
Okay. Here we go. So the first question, do you believe the reason Maura traveled to Haverhill has any significance in what happened to her?
No. No. She had been in that area before. There was a family friend cabin or place there that she could go. I don't think it's her family's cabin. I think it's friends of theirs that had a place. And I think that's where everybody thought she... Well, we certainly thought that's where she's headed.
Could that be her her friend from high school who had a cabin, I think, in Goshen?
Could be. It is a place she had been to before. She liked the White Mountains a lot, we know. Well, everybody knows, but yeah, could have been. And she also made a phone call to Burlington, Vermont. She was checking out information there about places to stay in that area. You know, she called a travel agency or a hotel or something.
Ghost Town.
Yeah. But she had a book with her in regards to deaths that had happened in the White Mountains. Mm-hmm. And I think we all kind of felt that she's headed there for a purpose, probably to get away from whatever was going on in her life. And we've speculated on that. But I don't think it had anything to do with her being killed traveling in that way.
Okay.
We all think it's total crime of opportunity, which suggests to us a disorganized person.
Interesting. Okay. So the next question is, who is and has been your number one suspect from day one?
Richard Forcier has been our suspect. After we worked on the case, did our interviews, and got the hits from the cadaver dogs where we got the hits, and the use of a psychic, Maureen Hancock, who, if you don't know Maureen Hancock, she is scary good. I've worked with probably three psychics in my career. One, I was a federal agent for a while, and I worked a serial killer case where Dorothy Allison, who was from Nutley, New Jersey, mm-hmm. came on board and helped us out. This guy was killing young girls, and she was scary. Moore Murray came to us through Alan Tate, who I think has been a private investigator his whole career. I don't think he's ever been a cop, but whatever. He knew about her and brought her into the case, and she gave us absolutely, you know, specific information, and that's the way she is. To tell you how accurate she is, we had one of our guys there, and we were waiting for her to arrive near where we knew the car was found. And Alan picked her up at her house, told her nothing. And she drove right to the spot where Morris's car was found. Now, there was two or three of us there to make sure there was nothing in the area that would indicate that anything had ever happened there, ever. So as they drove around the corner, and all the way there, she's telling them stuff. I'm in contact with this Mora. I'm in half an hour out. She says, Mora's going to lead me right to the place. As they drove around the corner, she backed the car up and said, no, it's right here. And, you know, that's where her car was. So she said, no, we want to go up here. And she drove by Forcier's house and stopped, said, stop the car, stop the car, stop the car. And she pointed over to, that's the guy that killed her. It's this guy, Richard. I don't remember the exact words. I haven't looked at the video. If I find it, I'll get you a copy of it. And he was coming out the door. And Alan said, they locked eyes like they were, you know, the devil and God going to fight each other. And she says, that's him. He's the guy that killed Moore. And wow. There's plenty of people out there that claim to be psychics or mediums and stuff. If you listen to some of what they have to say, it's very general. And then they start, folks, right. Oh, yeah, chest pain. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, everybody has, you know, and then they kind of move in. So most cops don't want to believe in them. I probably met with 50 in my career, and Dorothy Allison and Maureen Hancock were scary good. So long-winded. Did I answer that?
Well, can I go back to one thing that you said?
Yeah.
It was about the Godapper dogs.
Yes.
Hitting. Where was that?
Where were the hits?
Yeah.
So one of the hits was Ian was with a dog handler group, and he and their handler got a hit in the A-frame. My recollection is it was in the laundry room or something, but
yeah,
it was
downstairs closet,
and it was a good hit. Again, brought in a couple more dogs, legitimate hit. We found out later on that it had nothing to do with more, that there had been a dead body, somebody had died there, and it had nothing to do with her. Nothing to do with her. I can't say that, you know, 100%, but there certainly was a death there. So again, we kind of ruled it out. I think we even took some evidence from inside the place.
Carpet.
Yeah. That's maybe what we took. So
I know that John Healy has said that they had all but ruled out the A-frame. Is this what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we all kind of felt the same way. You know, it probably wasn't her.
So you just mentioned that you had determined that somebody died in there.
Yeah.
Most likely not Mora.
No. There was legitimately somebody had died in that house. I think we got that from Haverhill Dispatch.
So when people read that somebody had died in that house,
yeah.
I think people were automatically assuming that it was a crime scene. That, you know, people were wondering, is this somebody who's missing? Is
right.
this... Has there been resolution?
No, there was resolution.
Okay.
I mean, I know that Ian collected some evidence from the house before we knew. So if there had been anything that we would have been interested in, then, you know, we would have had some forensic evidence, and we could have gone back and done whatever if they didn't want to come. Mm-hmm. But that A-frame, you know, we were able to clear fairly quick.
Mm-hmm. So that's a resolved.
Okay. That's resolved. The non-resolved, you know, is the hits up on... up the road that we got. So where her car was found on the corner, that road that goes away from where her car was, is where we got a pretty good hit. So two or three dogs came in, alerted on the same area. It was a ways up the road as during the course of our searches. No, that's fine. I don't care.
But the road that goes away from her car, so is that Old Peters?
Old Peters Road. Yep, Old Peters Road.
Okay.
It was an area within our 5-mile radius easily enough. And during the course of that, the way we did the searches is that we took tape and we just made grids of the whole area, the whole 5-mile area that we were going to search. And some places we just definitively ruled out for whatever reason, property there, whatever it was. And the other areas we decided to is when we did the searches. So the teams consisted of the dog handler and her dog. I think there was one guy there too, but they were mostly females. One of us, we made sure that, you know, we were armed, that the people went with our arm because there's bears and stuff in the area. And we tried to make that person have a video camera with them as well as a still camera. So we've constantly videotaped the dogs doing whatever they were doing. So dog alerts, and a handler says it's a good alert. So I go over with my people and dog alerts again. And we kind of, at that point in time, I pull out some just plain evidence tape, cordon off an area, call Haverhill, call the AGs, no one's coming. Okay. So we talked about it, and I said, well, I'm going to dig. I mean, if they're not coming, I'm not going to let this evidence get lost. So we did find some stuff and bagged it, and it eventually got to the Attorney General's office. And we've never heard anything back. Is it her stuff? Is it whatever? But it was human clothing ripped, whatever, human, definitely human clothing. And it was some sort of a rubber latex piece, blue, that was in there.
Like a shoe?
Just a square, like, I think it was like about 4 by 5 inches, something like that. It was ripped. And we're in total disagreement with everybody else, probably. I thought he marked the spot where he had dumped her body. Because our feeling is that when Forcier grabbed her at his house, that she was certainly alive for a while. Maureen kind of confirms this. The other psychic, who I'm not sure about, but she confirmed it. But both of them said she's under his house, and there's a dirt floor there, and she's in there, and she's still alive. But at some point in time, he killed her and then moved her body at least once, if not twice. There was some speculation that he had her in a white van up near one of the ponds, that his white van was seen there. Hence, maybe the reason for she could have been in the pond. But I mean, we were all over that with the cadaver dogs and never got a hit. So she was there. She was not there. I don't know. Maybe she didn't even get out of the van. I don't know. But our feeling is that she was alive for a while, killed her, moved her out of his house, out of the trailer, and she went to that place on Old Peters Road.
Did you find any other things that could possibly have belonged to her?
No.
So it was just that clothing and the...
It was just some clothing, the latex, and that was essentially it.
But that went to the AG's office.
Went to the AG's office. We didn't process it. I mean, I can process for blood and semen, mm-hmm. and, you know, I have a small lab in my basement that I use for anything that I want to take a look at first. But we had decided we're not doing anything. We're not sending it to a private lab. Our agreement was pretty specific, and we really didn't want to screw stuff up. We didn't feel they were doing anything about the case, especially when you don't want to come out. But, you know, that was our agreement, and we decided we're going to abide by it. We're not going to screw these guys over. As much as we don't think anybody took an interest and clearly didn't do any kind of an investigation, we weren't going to break our promise to them.
I think you touched on this a little. What is your theory?
My theory is that for reasons unknown, including not an accident, she stopped at that corner. I think it probably had to do more mechanical and maybe the tailpipe. I don't know if that was enough. We had really conflicting statements from mechanics, but it could have caused a problem. And she got out. She's clearly making a phone call. She didn't have any cell service, so the call didn't come through. Atwood goes by and stops. Do you want any help? And she says, no, I'm on my cell phone trying. He says something about, well, you're not going to get service. And then she started walking. And I think she walked away, and Forcier may have seen her. Well, he certainly had contact with her. And he was able to overtake her and get her under his control and brought her in the house. And at some point in time, she's in the basement on dirt floor, and he had a dirt floor at the time. Yeah. The trailer that he was living at the time was a real total piece of shit. Yeah. And we found out where the trailer was once he started building his new house. So we went up cadaver dogs. Cadaver dogs alerted on his trailer. So we said, okay, we're going to back off, you know, because it's now an area where we could search and maybe find DNA.
So at this time, when you took the cadaver dogs, the trailer was on his property or had been moved?
Moved.
Okay.
He had started building his new place there. And so again, called AG, called this, called that. We discussed doing a real crime scene of the trailer and, you know, looking for DNA or looking for stuff. But when we talked to the AG about it, they said that they were going to take a look at it. Now, we're told by our AG contact that the state police did go there with their cadaver dogs and they would not give us any results at all. I also know the hole that we found and took stuff out of, they went back with their cadaver dogs. So we're told. But did they get any results? Did he find anything? Don't know. But, the you know, again, with Hancock, she's so specific that it points you in that direction. And then when you get the hit by the dogs, you're like, okay, she was in there. Mm-hmm. Can't be anybody else. Not that it couldn't be anybody else or not. Could be a coincidence, but I don't believe in coincidences. No such thing.
Can I go back to one thing that you said?
Yep.
And it might have just been like an offhand thing, but you said that he certainly had contact with her.
Well, he admitted to having contact with her.
And that was like shortly?
Shortly after the police are talking to him. And he makes that admission to the police. And then media people eventually get there a day or two later, whatever it was, as well as more cops. He told them all the same story. Said she wanted to have sex with me. She was walking by. And he's never been able to answer, well, why you? Are you standing outside? What's going on? But he admitted to that. I kind of believe he said it on television as well. But he definitely told the police. He definitely told Atwood. And without question, it happened. There's no doubt in my military mind that that happened.
But then 2 months later or 3 months later, he's saying that he saw her running 5 miles down the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you don't believe that there's any truth to the story that he tells months later that she's running down the road 5 miles, you know, he saw her?
No. Why would he be watching her 5 miles away?
Right.
Were you following her for 5 miles? You saw her 5 miles away? Mm. I don't think so.
Yeah.
There's no tracks. I mean, the other thing here is that they had some snow. There's no tracks going off any place. And that's one thing, you know, I give the police. They did note that. So if she felt scared and was running off or away from somebody, no. He abducted her. He got her into the house. He got her under his control. However, maybe he said, come on and use my phone. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think when she was walking toward that way, I think he gained control of her. And it was done. It was after that, it's over with.
Do you recall if Forcier had any scratches or?
Not that anybody noted.
Okay.
And we did make contact with the media. I'm trying to think. Somebody did that and asked those kinds of questions.
He's on camera somewhere.
Yeah.
Days after.
He also, I don't know if you guys know this, when the state police were there a day or two later with their dog, their tracking dog. You probably should know that. That's pretty public. Mm-hmm. So the dog tracked toward Forcier and Atwood's houses. And when Forcier was interviewed by police and or the media, he told them that Mora came to his house and wanted to have sex with him. And he let her in. And after they had sex, she left. And he had no clue where she was after that. And this is obviously after Atwood stops with the bus, and there's a exchange between Atwood and Mora, and then Atwood goes home. But Atwood was deathly afraid of Forcier. I mean, Healy went down to interview Atwood in Florida, you know, because he got pissed. He said, I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to take my wife, Muriel, down. We're going to go down there. I'm going to find this guy. I'm going to interview. He did. The guy wouldn't let him in the house. Atwood would not talk to him, would not let him in the house. So
I've heard several times that Atwood was afraid of
somebody
in the immediate area.
Yeah. Without question, he was afraid of Forcier. I mean, that's, you know, stuff we were picked up doing interviews and people, you know, connections that, you know,
and he was made. Essentially right across the street.
I mean,
yeah. So I have a question actually about that specifically. So Healy went to Florida and tried to talk to Atwood. And he's quoted in an article as mentioning that Atwood was living a very comfortable life.
Yeah.
And had a boat and, you know, clearly a different life than he had been living in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Was there some idea that Atwood had maybe been paid off because Forcier took out quite a large second mortgage,
yeah,
and it was around the time of this,
yeah,
and so, you know, then you see somebody come into a lifestyle that he hadn't previously led.
Yeah.
So was there any talk of that? Was there any idea of that?
Especially when John had gone down, you know, made his vacation around talking to Atwood, essentially. That's stuff you talk about, you know, did the police pay him off? Did, you know, you don't know how much money people have hidden away or in the bank or something like that.
Yeah.
When people are not cooperative or lie, you know, the trick is, how come? How come you're lying to me? Well, you generally have something to hide. What is that? Well, you have knowledge of the crime. You did the crime. You're afraid of somebody. It's jealousy. It's, you know, money or whatever. Drug cases are buy drugs undercover if you can. Mm-hmm. If not, and or follow the trail of the money. So we get tax records because we have an IRS agent on our team. Check the tax record. He makes $15,000 a year and he's got a $25,000 car that's paid for it. So how the hell did you do that? And that is evidence you can testify to.
Right.
And say, I don't know how he's making this money, mm-hmm. but it's money that can't be accounted for. Mm-hmm. That would be a lead, you know, that any follow-up by the cold case squad, that would be something they should have followed up on.
Yeah, right.
That's a way. I mean, cold cases are notoriously difficult to solve, but you got to follow what you got now, and how is it different then?
Did your team examine the interior of Mora's car for blood, and or did you find any?
No. They wouldn't even let me look at the car.
Do you think that's abnormal?
Absolutely abnormal. I call myself a forensic scientist at this point in time, and certainly to the tail of my career. I've been court qualified as an expert in accident reconstruction and crime scene reconstruction. And to me, the disciplines are so much the same. I don't care if it's a car. I don't care if it's a hole in the ground. It makes no difference to me. It's a bunch of forensic evidence that I got to figure out what I'm going to take, how I'm going to, all that kind of stuff. So the car, you know, I certainly had intentions of doing blood studies in it, if any, you know, using crime lights and using other chemicals and stuff to look for blood. We were able to get some photographs, and there's a number of people that have said, I think even the state police once even said that she hit the snowbank. Mm-hmm. No. Emphatically, no. And other people have talked about her hitting the tree. Yeah. No. Emphatically, no. She didn't hit the tree. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, the tree makes a nice oval-shaped dent in your car. The damage that she has is, some of it's what's called induced damage, but where the first point of contact is what's called an override. Somebody either backed up into her above her bumper with a higher bumper and pushed it in, because you can see a nice clear impression right there. Yeah. And that energy gets dissipated throughout the car in terms of crumble damage. I think she had a crack in her windshield on that side. That's all the kind of stuff you expect from an override accident. She did not hit a tree, snowbank. That was a joke. I can't even believe they said that. I think because they don't know. Where it happened, don't know. Did it happen recently? Don't know, because I wasn't able to look at the damage and make a determination. Is this really fresh, or has it got some rust, or it's over? Again, pictures are nice to look at. Mm-hmm. I need to look at the damage. Mm-hmm. I need to measure it, analyze it. I mean, everything with me is physics, geometry, algebra, and they're actually very simple math equations. And put things together like speed. Can you figure out the object? You know, what speed would have caused that impact? And we tried and tried, and they would not let me look at the vehicle.
So you've never?
I've never seen the vehicle live. I would love to see the vehicle live and make some determinations.
So at that point, who was it not allowing you to see the vehicle?
State police.
Okay.
Yeah. Wherever they had stored it, and I suspect they probably stored it actually in Concord.
It's in Concord now.
Yeah, that's where I always look at their cars. You go to their headquarters there, and they have a junkyard in the back. I've looked at 30, 40, 50 cars there. But this one, no, not letting you. I said, and I don't care if you videotape me. You know, just watch everything I do. And nope. Okay. All right.
I don't want to ask you to speculate too much, but is there any reason that you can think of why that might be the case? Like, if they think that could potentially be like the crime scene?
Well, it's certainly part of the crime scene. Mm-hmm. Whatever involvement it has, I don't know. And I would be highly speculative in saying they don't either. Because if they're saying that damage came from a snowbank, that I'm like, oh my God. Like every police department, New Hampshire State Police has some people that are, this guy's really good. You know, did a good job. Nothing I can say. I've done accidents where they've had to crash on the wrong side of the road. And I'm looking at, it took me a couple of days once to figure this out, because I said, no, I'm looking at this. And I said, it's on the wrong side of the road. So I call, it was a private guy. I called the attorney, and he can't believe it. But some as bad as that. So I don't trust them to do a thorough job. I just don't. If they could speak to me and tell me everything that they did, my feeling is I'd probably find something new, because everybody does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would love to look at that car.
Yeah.
She did not have an accident on that corner. So that would be a help for me to kind of look at that and, you know, kind of put some more stuff together and say, this is what I think.
Backing up to one thing that you said about the damage and it being from perhaps being backed into.
Yeah.
Would that be enough force to deploy the airbags?
Oh, yeah.
It would.
Yeah. Airbags, even today, are kind of tricky.
Right.
The system is definitely not perfect.
Especially in 2004 or 1996.
Yeah.
But the car was 96.
Yeah. So it may not have hit. It may not have hit the sensors. There's sensors around. I mean, they're all over the place now, but 96, it wouldn't have surprised me. But again, don't know.
Right.
You know, if I look at the damage, take a look at where it is, where's the nearest sensor? Okay. That's kind of how the analysis would kind of go.
Did the pictures that you took, were they detailed enough that you could see the like the indentation and see if there was any paint or any...
No. And I've scanned them. I use Macs because I just like them. I think they're better than Windows. So I have a pretty high-end Mac, and, you know, I scanned everything in and tried to explode it as much as I could, and I just can't get close enough to see stuff like that. I didn't take the photographs. One of our people did, and I don't even know how he was able to photograph it. And I never asked him, but when I do them, you know, I do crime scene photographs. You know, I'm all around the car, then I'm close-ups and all that kind of jazz. So he didn't really have that opportunity to do, I think, what he would have done. He's a good photographer, too. So,
do you think the driver or Mora smashed their head into the windshield? And if so, to what extent of injury would that have caused?
If she hit her head, and I'd have to look at the photograph again, I think I said she probably didn't hit her head. There would clearly be a concentrical, a star-like pattern mm-hmm. from her head. So blood, hair, fibers from her clothes, maybe. There would be some pretty good evidence there.
So most likely the windshield, the crack that was in the windshield,
I think
would
came
have
from
been
the,
a result from somebody maybe backing up into her or yeah. whatever impact hit the front of the
yeah.
the
because
car.
The energy will right up to the windshield.
Right.
And the windshields crack all the time, even minor impacts.
Yeah.
Because the energy has to go someplace. It has to dissipate itself. And it dissipates itself by broken, you know, metal crumbling, the glass cracking mm-hmm. and breaking. That energy gets up through the car and it just dissipates through that.
Mm. Okay. It has been said that the entire exhaust system had been removed and taken into evidence. It seems the obvious reason would be because of the rag in the tailpipe. Were there any other reasons besides the rag in the tailpipe that the exhaust was removed for evidence?
Well, they took the entire car into evidence.
Right.
So the fact that the tailpipe's on it, would they have taken it off to look at it? I would have.
Yeah.
You know, looking for latent prints, looking for DNA, hair fiber, whatever, mm-hmm. and using, you know, use all the tools we have now. Crime lights, everything else, you know, I have a digital microscope that I bring with me. Yeah, they should have taken it off. Don't know if they did. I know they didn't take the tailpipe or exhaust and leave the car. Mm-hmm. They took everything.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe Mora was driving the Saturn at the crash site? Do you believe there was only one accident and it happened at the weathered barn?
I think she was the only person in the car, and I think she was driving the car. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence to suggest otherwise. Where she had the crash totally would be speculative on my part. All I know is that it didn't happen there, and it was an override accident.
Can you say for sure that all the damages to the car were caused by the crash on February 9th, is it possible that there were any damages to the car prior to the crash in which Mora went missing?
I think the damage clearly could not and did not, under any circumstances, take place on that corner. I mean, anybody who thinks that, I'm like, tell me how. Mm. Snow? Are you kidding me? Ice? Are you kidding me? Tree? No. Crash a car into a tree. See, look at what you got. You know, it's a very patterned impression that is an override.
Do you think she did spin out, though?
No. No indication that she really spun out at all in that corner. Could she have? Sure. Do I think so? No. The road's not very wide. There's no indication from anybody who was at the scene that showed the marks of her spinning out, doing a 360, a 180, or anything like that at all. Could she have lost control when she went around the corner? I don't think so. I mean, I would testify, no, I don't think so, because there's no evidence of her going very far off the road.
Yeah, I don't think that there were skid marks.
No skid marks. But you would have, when you're going around that way, there's two forces, there's three forces that work on your car as we're going down the road. Gravity, centripetal force, which is force to the inside, and centrifugal force, which is force to the outside. So if you're making a sharp curve to the left, depending on your speed is what force is going to act on you the most, whether you're going to go to the inside or go to the outside. And there's nothing in anything that I've seen or any of the police officer statements that suggest that she slid or she skidded or anything like that at all.
Can you think of a reason why her car would have been turned around like that? That's the only thing that makes me think she didn't necessarily just decide to stop.
I think her car was parked in the same direction she was going, wasn't it?
It was turned around. So facing west in the eastbound lane. So essentially on the wrong side.
Yeah.
Right. That's actually not what the dispatch log says.
No. And we've always been under the impression, have always believed that she was going, where her car was pointed was where she was going.
Was there, in your opinion, a second or first accident involving Maura at or around 7 p.m. that evening?
I can't answer that without having to, you know, without having looked at the evidence soon after it happened.
There's some talk about a scanner call that
okay.
people overheard about a car that had gone off the road on Swiftwater and ended up leaving. And I think there's been some idea that it may have been her.
Not anything we've heard.
Okay.
And because I would have been the one to go out and check out Swiftwater Road and mm-hmm. see where her car might have collided.
Well, maybe I'm misstating Swiftwater Road. Was it road or Swiftwater?
No, I think it was Swiftwater Road. But
okay.
That's going from a memory, so...
Yeah.
You know, there's like Swiftwater Circle, there's Swiftwater right.
oh, yeah.
area. I mean, there's a lot of things named Swiftwater, so it's
right.
hard to...
You know. Okay. Yeah. Doesn't mean a thing to me right now.
Okay. In your opinion, was Maura's accident really a single car accident, or do you believe that she was either forced off the road or that there was possibly another car that contributed? Do you think the scent dogs were actually tracking Maura or somebody else?
No, I think the scent dogs were clearly tracking Maura, number one, because you get a scent out of the car. That's hers, and they'll follow that. And mm-hmm. they did. They followed at 80 yards, whatever the hell it was. Could another car have been involved? Absolutely. Could another car forced her off the road? You could probably set up a scenario with two cars where Moore's behind and the other car jammed on its brakes, something like that. But again, you have clearly have an override. So one way to try to find out what the other car was would be to measure that override ground up, mm-hmm. you know, the width of it, the height of it, the indentation depth, and see if you can find a car bumper that fits that. It could easily be a stationary object that she hit. And I did measure bus bumpers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what Forcier had was driving at the time. I think he had a van, the yep. white van thing.
Yep.
Yeah, so we did check that out. Well, I checked that out, but no.
So that you've ruled out the van?
I've ruled out the van. We definitely ruled out the school bus as contributing to this because there was really nothing on either. It was a too high or... Both of them are actually kind of high to do what they did and not be able to cause that pattern indentation. I think I actually called the school department and asked them about were any additions or anything done to any of the buses, and they said no.
Would you say it's like a pickup truck hitch or something? Like, do you think it would?
I don't think it was a hitch because you would have a very definitive pattern okay. from that ball and the mm-hmm. hitch part. Could have been a pickup truck, something that's it's a little higher off the ground to override everything in the front. And so maybe a part of a bumper guard or something. It looked kind of square to me. Something like that.
Okay.
You know, I thought of, guardrails in front of store, all kinds of stuff like that she may have backed into. Let me look at the guard, people.
Yeah.
And maybe they've already come to an opinion. I don't know.
I saw in a different group where you said the house where we believe Maura is buried under is not owned by the suspect anymore. We need to connect with them and bring in a cadaver dog to search. There are some other ideas I have as well. Has anybody connected with the current owners? Do you know?
I know we connected with them early on when they first got the house. I think Healy called everybody and said, hey, Forcier sold his house to some people. So we're like, hey, let's get the dog in there.
Yeah.
There was some... not wanting to do that on the part of the owners. And I didn't talk to him. I didn't, not saying I'm going to make any difference in what anybody else did. I'm pretty sure it's probably John. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to do that. We actually had dogs lined up. Now, someone told me that I believe the state police brought their dogs in. But I don't know that factually. But in terms of relooking at the case, I don't care who lives there now. That would be something we'd want to do.
Do you know where Rick Forcier's land in Pennsylvania was, and do you know if it's been searched?
I don't know if it's been searched, and I don't recall where it is.
We talked about this. Was Rick Forcier the subject of the grand jury? You don't know if there has.
I can't say I'm 100% sure, because I can't, yeah. But I would be 99.999% sure there was no grand jury.
Okay. Assuming if he was, there was not enough evidence to convict without a body... Is that a correct line of thinking.
No, you don't need a body to convict anybody.
Right.
You know, and here, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, the dog alerts in the area, you know, the stuff that he lied about. It's circumstantial at best. Not that you can't get convictions on circumstantial evidence. Mm-hmm. You certainly can. But nothing really to back it up in terms of any solid evidence like Atwood coming forward or Forestier's ex-wife coming forward and said he told me that. You know, any DNA found in the trailer, things like that, that would have been, you know, bang, zoom stuff. And that's why, unless somebody talks and we're able to find her or somebody finds her, I don't think it's going to get cleared until there's a major event that happens of some sort.
Have you seen any of the videos he's put on YouTube?
Forestier?
Yeah.
No.
So he has put several music videos on YouTube. One called the Stalker video, the Stalker song, sorry. And a large number of people in the community have, the Moore Murray community, have kind of picked apart the lyrics. And I wondered if you had seen them, if you thought it was a game of taunting. But if you haven't seen them.
I haven't seen them, but I'm definitely going to look at them.
Yeah.
I can do this, but I don't do it much because Healy's so much better. It's something called statement analysis. Mm-hmm. It's taking a written statement, so you know what it's mm-hmm. about. And that would be something that John should take a look at.
That work in a sort of artistic expression?
Kind of. But various words that you use that are inappropriate to the present situation, like you say somebody's name in past tense when you don't know if they're dead or not. It's all kinds of stuff like that. John is really good at it. And I'll have to mention this to him.
It would be amazing if he looked at them. I mean, in particular, the Stalker song is...
That's the one, like, it's a woman who, like, sneaks up on him or, like, into his trailer or whatever.
Yeah, he's really sitting on the couch and then a kind of masked woman sneaks up on his porch, maybe comes through a back door or a window, I don't remember.
That's pretty close for comfort.
Yeah.
You know?
I know, I've thought about that too, but I almost wonder if he's like making fun of the fact that people think that's what happened.
Yeah.
It's like, it's hard to...
It is hard to tell.
Because it's an artistic
thing. Right.
So. Yeah. What would I say? I don't think so. I don't think he's making fun of anything. I think he's just... He has been caught, even though people know him. He's got to know people know he's, you know, think of him as killing Maura. And he's just laughing because he's gotten away with it for so long.
Is there, since she hasn't been found, do you believe there's a possibility she's on private property? And I think he means her
body. Yeah. Yeah. If people didn't care and were willing to help you out, find somebody's body.
Yeah.
Hey, go do whatever you dig my yard up front and rear. I don't care. Right. Do what you got to do.
Right.
And, you know, when he denied that to us and to everybody else, okay, how come? Why won't you let us search with the dogs? How come?
That kind of sends suspicion right away.
Immediately. I mean, I can understand people not talking and being afraid of being arrested and interviewed. I get mm-hmm. that because maybe they've never done it before. But when you're looking for a missing person and right in front of your house practically, and you don't want to allow us to search for her or belongings or something, how come?
I'll play devil's advocate for one.
Sure.
There. If he had any sort of sense that he might be the suspect, I think he might be a little bit more reluctant to sort of open himself up because he loses nothing by saying no, except perhaps like, the perception of...
Well, you go right on, you go, and you tell them, you go right on the list. You're at the top of my list right now.
Right.
Innocent people. There's lots of interview techniques how to crack people. We don't need to talk about that. But if an innocent person, when you're getting in their face and you're doing your mojo, trying to get them to talk to you or confess, they're going to deny. And that's really a pretty good sign of somebody being innocent. What can I do to help you? Take my fingerprints. Take my DNA. What do you want? Oh, my sneaker prints. What? They'll do everything in their power to prove to you that they're innocent. So it's classic when somebody denies right from the very beginning. Nope, not going to let you in my house. Okay, well, if you got weed in there, you got a pound of coke. I really don't care. I'm trying to find this girl. You know, I'll put it in writing. I won't arrest you if I find a pound of coke in here. Whatever. But when they deny you access to trying to find this poor girl, that's a red flag that they're guilty.
The only exception, though, I think in his case, if it is something criminal that he's worried about, but doesn't necessarily have to do with
it. You're not going to be looking for that. Nobody would have been looking, you know, in the drawers there. Nobody would have been looking at his computer if he had one. You know, we're looking for her. So you're kind of down to a body, or living or dead. And that's, you know, kind of what you would base yourself. So I don't care what anything you have in here. I promise you. He's not going to believe it because he's a bum. But let me look around. Let me walk around. You walk around with me. Open the doors for me, whatever you want to do. If there's something you don't want me to see behind there, you know, open the door so I can at least peek in. Make sure there's nobody in there.
That's kind of what I was thinking. If he would have said no, with those other things in mind, you know, like I have everybody else's prescriptions in my house or whatever.
You don't care about that at the time. You're trying to find this girl.
Right.
Yeah. I do think that there's horror stories of people being, like, you know, somebody finds a joint and then they're arrested for murder.
Right, right.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, that goes back to bad cops.
Yeah.
You know, they talk their way into your house. They don't find anything. They plant something, you know, whatever. But an investigation will weed through that.
Did you also ask to do a cadaver dog search?
Yeah, that's what we asked him.
Okay.
That's specifically what we asked him. Said the girl's missing. If we, you know, she may be dead, can we bring the dogs onto your property? Nothing about the house or anything at the time.
Wow. Well, and it was a flat out no.
Yeah, flat out no. Nope. Don't let me catch him on there. I'll shoot you and your dogs. That kind of crap. Okay. You're going to have about...
Did you consider just waiting till he left?
We thought, you know, we thought about a lot of things. Because there comes a point in time when you don't care.
Right.
Do it, sue me, call me a bad guy. I don't really care. All we want to do is find her. And we did think about things like that. We did say, hey, we'll wait till he leaves. We'll let the dogs loose on the property. If they get inside, they get inside. Whatever. and we just decided, you know, it's not ethical on our part. Mm. And we're not doing Fred... Well, we probably would have been doing Fred good by finding her. But, you know, we're going to ruin an investigation, being able to charge somebody who could be a serial killer. And, you know, it's us. You know, there's not much. I'm not a rich guy. I'm a cop all my whole life, you know. But one thing you can't take away from us is our integrity. Mm-hmm. You don't have enough money to buy me. $50 million? Not enough. We're not going to spend $50 million in jail? No. And all of the people we had, I think we all felt very comfortable that we knew each other previously so well, especially like John and I have been friends for a year because I did drug work in New Hampshire, that it's just not happening. We're not going to do anything unethical that's going to screw anything up.
That's actually good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different than what we've
Well, not everybody. Yeah. Yeah.
This probably calls for some speculation on your part, but do you think there's a specific reason that people have inserted themselves into this case?
Well, I think there's a couple different reasons that certain people have decided we're going to take this on. I think a lot of people think that they could be an armchair detective, mm-hmm. or they can make a film, or they can do a documentary, or they can do whatever. Most of the time, I don't think they're doing a good thing. I think they're doing it because it brings some light onto their company or them as an individual or whatever. I've known one guy who did a documentary on a case. It was a golfer. It was a female golfer. First female professional golfer in Vermont was found dead. And everybody had a suspect and all of that. He went out and really put together a really good job. And the guy ended up fessing up. He was in jail in California. He had to bring him back to Vermont. He did fess up to it. But he did a really good job of covering everything. And I told him, I said, I'm not reinvestigating this. You investigate it. I'll talk to you about the crime scene aspect of blood spatter or whatever the hell. And he did a really good job. And he gave the movie away for free. He wasn't looking for any money. He wasn't looking for any press. He's kind of a low-key guy that does this once in a while. The stuff that I saw, and I just dropped out after the first or second episode. I'm like, none of this is true. I mean, a lot of what you're seeing on this documentary is very speculative. Mm. And then you kind of see somebody and you're going to chase them down the road. And I'm like, I don't get this. So do you do it to satisfy a personal craving? Yeah, could be. Do you do it because you want some publicity? Yeah. Do you want to interject yourself into a high profile case, whether you're writing a book or whether you're doing a documentary? Yeah. You're going to get something out of it personally. Are you doing it to help out the family? No. Because that's not the way you do it. Not in my opinion. I mean, I know there was some good stuff with Fred, and rightfully so. But you're not going to clear this case until we find her body. You can speculate all day long. You can do this. You can write books. You can do whatever. And I'm sorry, it's not going to go anywhere until she's found.